Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. You are listening to Voices for Justice tonight, October 6, 2010. I'm your host, Michelle Bart, and tonight we will have a voice for justice as we talk about the domestic and sexual violence in America and in Clark County, Washington. October is National Domestic Violence Awareness Month, and now 16 years since the Violence Against Women Act, VAWA, was passed, we ask you to join the conversation and let us all take a stand against violence acts against women, children, and all victims. I encourage you to join us in the chat room at blogtalkradio.com/helpingheroes or call in with your questions to our guest this evening. The phone number is 347-838-8622. Tonight we will welcome our friend Deborah Adams, who is with the YWCA Clark County. She is Director of Safe Choice in Vancouver, Washington. We also are very honored to have with us Susan Powell's father. She's the missing mother from Utah, and we will hear from Chuck Powell in a few minutes. I just would like to let everyone know that's listening to the show this evening that the links are posted in the chat room and also on our website that we will be referring to throughout the program. Chuck, Deborah, welcome to the show this evening.
Thank you.
Hi, Michelle.
Hi, how are you both? Thank you, Deborah. Thank you for joining us. I wanted to start off first. Let's start off with the signs of abuse. I wanted to just dive right into that, Deborah, so that our listeners listening, if you are in danger or need help, I encourage you to call 911 or also the local hotline for the YWCA Clark County, which is 360-695-0501. But let's talk about a little bit about the abuse factor and what the signs are, Deborah.
Okay, I think a really important thing is to remember that domestic violence happens in the context of a relationship, which makes it complicated. So it doesn't usually begin with a physical assault. There's usually other things that happen prior to that, such as verbal abuse, emotional abuse, financial abuse, social abuse, and so on. But one of the really big common denominators of most everyone that we have worked with at the Safe Choice Domestic Violence Program for the last, say, 16 years that I've been working for them, is they talk about the feeling of isolation. So partners who are very controlling and abusive tend to isolate their victims. And by that I mean, for instance, moving you across state so that you have more difficulty reaching your friends and your family. That's a very common denominator in what we've heard from survivors and thrivers of domestic violence. So that's one thing I always look for. Also, if you notice the people in your life, a couple that's close to you, and you notice that there are really strict gender role assignments, that can be a cue to look into. For instance, if there's a man who's the husband and man says, this is my job. I fix the car. I do the yard. This is your job. You're the woman. You're the wife. You wash the dishes, and you do the laundry, and you care for the kids. And they don't want to stray from those.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what that is.
Oh, go ahead.
Okay. So watch for that as well as... I don't know if that's coming from. Anyway, so watch for isolation and extreme gender role assignments, and also look for jealousy. Jealousy is a big one because often jealousy is mistaken as a sign of true love. That means you love someone so much you're not willing to share them. So I think in relationships that's a romantic, seen as romantic and a positive aspect in the beginning of a relationship, but as the relationship continues it becomes more and more controlling, more and more isolating, and more restrictive. those are some of the main things that I would want to talk about.
Now, those are the signs of abuse. Let me go to Chuck for a minute. I know that Susan went missing on December 7th last year, 2009, from her West Valley City, Utah home. Were there any signs that your family brought to Susan's attention before her disappearance?
Yes, there were. In her relationship, and actually from the beginning, we didn't see the type of care that we would expect of a husband for a wife. It was more like Susan was treated as property or as an asset rather than as a person and somebody that you love. It's the little things that you would expect a person would feel for another, that do for another, the holding hands, the opening doors, the helping with your coat, just the little things of common kindness and courtesy and love that were lacking in the beginning, that were danger signs to us.
Now, can you give us a little bit without, I know that it's still under investigation and we're still looking for Susan, but can you tell us a little bit about where the investigation is right now and what investigators on a domestic violence, have they considered any of this stuff that the family has recognized prior to her gone missing?
Well, the investigators have working on the case, and they're looking into trying to get a picture of what was actually going on at the time. And of course, they're profiling things and trying to figure out exactly how the relationship was and all that. So they've talked to us, they've talked to her friends, anyone that has knew them as a couple or knew them individually, and to get the personalities of each one. So I'm sure they're working on those aspects of it, but currently, they're still collecting evidence without a body to find, to explain things, without a body currently, without definitive, you know, proof that she's deceased or anything like that. Well, they have to leave everything open because we hear about people coming back from being abducted for quite a while, and also people who just leave for no apparent reason. And so it's very difficult for the police to close their minds and just go straight down one path without making sure they investigate all avenues.
Deborah, obviously the signs of abuse is much different than the signs of a victim, where folks like us, if we're around a loved one like Chuck and Judy were with Susan, that there are different signs that we may recognize that obviously the individual being abused doesn't notice. Could you give us a few signs that our listeners could be more alert to?
Things to look for in the people you know and love that you think are experiencing a violent relationship. I would look for extreme behavior changes. In other words, if they're very outgoing and demonstrative and talkative and fun-loving, and then all of a sudden they're in a relationship and they do a 180 where they're quiet and reserved and withdrawn, that would be something that might clue you in. The problem with domestic violence is survivors, and I count myself in that group because I was married to an abusive man for 17 years, is that we look like normal people. And there's no stereotypical vision of what a survivor of domestic violence looks like. I mean, I think I'm a very average person. I remind people a lot of their mothers or their aunts or their sisters or their neighbor. There's not a particular look. Another thing to think about, though, is if explanations for injuries. If you see an injury and you ask your loved one about it, and they say, I walked into the door. And you look at the pattern of bruising on their upper arm, and it really reminds you of a clenched fist. you know, if you can see where that was a hand that made that, and that it was not, obviously not walking into a door that caused that. So when you can see those kinds of things, most survivors of domestic violence are going to deny that this is happening. For one, because it's really embarrassing. It's very humiliating to admit to anybody else that the person who says they love you the most is hurting you at home behind closed doors. And that's a
now,
really
both of you,
thing to be true.
Both of you mentioned the fact that control is a major component to the profile of an abuser. Chuck, let me ask you, knowing your story and knowing and meeting your family recently, again, and if I cross the line with the investigation, just let me know. But this particular individual that was or is married to your daughter recently moved to the state of Washington. And would you consider that control moving down the street from you folks with your grandchildren and denying you the access to seeing them? Would that be a control issue that might be a sign as well, Deborah or Chuck, either one?
I don't see it as that.
You don't see that, Chuck? Well, I see that a lot of people who are extremely abusive will withhold affection or control interactions. And they may, the abuser in this case may be afraid that the children are going to maybe even inadvertently share information with you that you might be able to use against him. So that could be one reason why he might be limiting your access to the children. I think if you live in Washington and they met and married in Washington and moved down to Utah, I could see that as being a form of control and the starting of the extreme isolation, which took your daughter right away from you, where you can see her every day and you can notice little changes and have a chance to have conversations with her that the partner can't control. So I think it's just a perspective, and I'm not, you know, not everybody's the same. So I don't want to say that that is definitely the way it is, but what we've seen in the work with other survivors of domestic violence, that is fairly common.
I think the thing for me that I'd like people to know is that Susan was convinced that she was doing everything she could for that marriage. She wanted to please her husband. She wanted to be that perfect wife and mother. She wanted to do everything to make it work. And the warning signs for me were when she was the only one working and he was running the finances. And he could buy anything he wanted, but she wasn't allowed to have basic necessities, couldn't provide for the children for food or clothing. Without you know, scrimping and saving, you know, buy your clothes at the Goodwill, grow your own groceries and that kind of stuff. And basically, but if he wants a toy, he wants a new computer part or anything he wants is important. What you want isn't. And I saw that as very, you know, I'm right, you're wrong all the time. That was abuse. It was control of finances. It was control of who your friend, who you can visit, who you can't, that type of stuff. But the thing is, she thought she could control, was in control and could have a handle on it. And although once she realized that that was indeed abuse, because it wasn't physical abuse, it was just emotional abuse and some verbal abuse, but mostly just emotional abuse, that is still abuse, and you have to realize that you have the right to your own self-control of your finances, and you have a say in where money's spent, and you don't have to be this, you know, person who take all the relinquish all your control. That is not a normal relationship, just to relinquish all the control to your husband or your wife or whoever. So that was not normal. She did not recognize it. And obviously, she probably stayed too long in the relationship. We don't know the end of the story yet, but it's clear that she thought she could handle it, and apparently she couldn't.
Did you find that in Susan's situation that this individual, which we'll remain nameless, that he tend to, or she tended to make him into something he wasn't to all of you, such as, you know, so-and-so, you know, oh, he's great with the kids. He took the kids out tonight. He's changed the oil in the car and made him to be something your family knew he wasn't.
Well, she did try to always defend him and try to minimize the unreasonable behavior. When we would say, hey, that's not right, that shouldn't happen that way, she would always try to defend and try to make an excuse for that, yes.
Mm-hmm. Deborah, is that a typical sign that you see with the victims that come through Safe Choice and the YWCA?
Yes. Absolutely.
I want to remind listeners, the call-in number to ask Deborah or Chuck a question is 347-838-8622. And tonight we are discussing domestic violence in America and in your backyard. October is National Domestic Violence Awareness Month. Deborah, let's talk a little bit about statistics, because I'm hearing a pattern here listening to the two of you, and I'm seeing that the victims that you see every day and Susan and many people I know in my personal life fall into these categories. According to the Domestic Violence Resource Center in Hillsboro, Oregon, they find, and remember, these numbers, when we talk statistics to our listeners, statistics are reported facts. In domestic violence, correct me if I'm wrong, Deborah, you don't typically see every person that's abused reported.
Absolutely.
Is that correct? Okay,
that is correct.
So these statistics, well, even though that they seem very high, you might as well double this, if not triple them. One in four women have experienced domestic violence. That's between 1 million to 6 million women become victims each year. Nearly 3 out of 4 Americans know someone who has been or who is being victimized in domestic violence and or sexual violence. On average, the center states 3 women and 1 man are murdered by their intimate partners in the country every day. That's quite a bit. But what really hit home to me was the 15.5 million children that witness some form of domestic violence annually.
Yes.
And in Susan's case, we know that she has 2 children. And so even though she went missing on December 7th, there's no telling what the children had seen prior to that. Have you had that opportunity to talk about Susan and the history between she and her husband with the kids, Chuck?
Oh, absolutely not. Nope. We've had no chance at all to talk with the children about that. And I don't know that I would at their age right now. As they grow older, obviously, they're going to ask more questions, and we have plans that if to see that they see a counselor and actually deal with the situations, whatever they may have witnessed.
Deborah, are there services through the YWCA for not only the mother but the children as well?
Well, when people stay in our shelter, we do try to make arrangements for the children to have a chance to play as children and not be placed in an adult role, because often children who witness domestic violence are kind of forced to grow up sooner. They need to help keep younger siblings quiet. They need to run errands. They need to protect the parent that's being abused. So there's a lot of effects on kids that often don't become, you know, extremely visible. So we have, in the shelter, we try to have opportunities to talk with the kids and where kids can talk to us safely. We get permission from the parents if they're young. Average age for kids in the shelter, the most common ages are between 2 and 12. However, over the past, say, 5 to 6 years, I would say the age category has extended. We've had several families with several teenagers in shelter. And that's a very difficult thing for teenagers to be facing as well.
I met a gentleman that I had known in Los Angeles. He's also an actor, but he recently became an author of a book called A Private Family Matter. His name is Victor Rivers, and I was introduced to him actually by the YWCA Greater Portland. And I encourage anyone listening who does have children at home that you know you're in a situation where you may feel like you can't get out, or you're staying with your significant other spouse for the children's sake, I encourage you to read A Private Family Matter. He was a child of abuse, and he was also a child of witnessing abuse to his mother. And so it's a compelling vision and journey through the eyes of a little boy. And he's a great actor, too, so I encourage you to read that. Statistically, again, going back to the Domestic Violence Resource Center, domestic violence obviously comes in a lot of forms. Statistically, though, in sexual and physical assaults, they say 3 in 4 women who report they have been raped and or physically assaulted since the age of 18 said it came from a partner that committed the crime. And 1 out of 5 women have reported that they had been raped or sexually assaulted in their lifetime. Let's explore the types of abuse. When we say domestic violence, everyone thinks it's your husband beating you up. And that is obviously the most common form. But there's a lot of different types of abuse. And if you could let our listeners know, Deborah, a few of those, and obviously recently we've known a lot about bullying. So what does the Y see?
Well, we see that many times people come to us and say, I don't even know why I'm here. I had a friend or a family or a counselor who suggested I come, but I don't think I'm in a domestic violence relationship because I haven't been beaten up. So we need to recognize that these other forms of abusive behaviors are just as impactful as the actual physical and sexual assault, as serious and as dangerous as those two types of violent behaviors are. What many survivors have said is, you know what, the verbal and emotional abuse is actually the worst because I'm still hearing it in my head. I still hear that voice. I am still controlled by all those things that were said to me and that made me rethink who I am as a person. So verbal and emotional abuse is really a powerful way to get people within control. And what we need to really recognize is those are not against the law. Those types of behaviors are not against the law. You cannot call 911 and say, my partner has just called me the worst name in the world. I've never, you know, they'll say, so what? So you're not in immediate danger. And so that will be a problem. And so we need to, as a society, learn to recognize these things as just as impactful and just as harmful as the physical beatings and the sexual assaults and rape.
But wouldn't you say that that's the onset of a possible stalking situation, a possible more criminal activity towards that individual if they have that much temper and animosity towards their significant other, that could only be the onset of something greater?
It could be. I would say that what we look for when we're having conversations with people is we look for the pattern of abusive behaviors and that they happen over a time period and that the periods between kinds of abuses shorten and the abuses intensify and escalate. So very often a partner will use verbal abuse to maybe get their partner to be quiet. You know, they're tired of listening to the talk or they're nagging them. So they'll call them a name and tell the survivor says, okay, I won't do that anymore. But after a while, the survivor says, you know what, I'm tired of not being able to use my voice. I'm going to go ahead and do it. So then the abusive partner has to step up the form of abuse, you know, increase the abuse and intensify the kinds of behaviors. So that's the kind of pattern we're looking for. It's not usually a one-time incident. Those kinds of abusive relationships, one of the partner usually may have some mental health disorder, might be a sociopath or a psychopath, and that's where your stalking then becomes more engaged, I believe, because that's kind of like the ultimate control, the stalking. You know, if I say I'm going to leave you and you say no, I'm not, and I do it anyway, that is just like a direct challenge to the abuser person to say, oh, you know, I am going to make you do what I want you to do. And that's when those stalking behaviors come in to play, I believe, more.
So since we've explored the signs of abuse and the signs that we may see in a victim that's maybe being abused, Chuck, let me ask you, with knowing what you know now, you all have started the SusanCoxFoundation.org. For listeners, you can go to SusanCoxFoundation.org, a great website of resources to have a voice for justice, have a voice for Susan, and most importantly, have a voice for any other victims that might be out there. What are you learning, and what empowers you as a parent going through something like this, and what kind of advice can you give to our listeners that might be in the same boat that you were?
Yeah, okay. Well, we went with the name SusanCoxPowellFoundation.org because some of the other names have been taken, so the actual website is SusanCoxPowellFoundation.org. I know it's kind of long, but anyway. And what we found is that people well, Susan's story, we've got enough coverage and nationwide exposure through computers and Facebook, email, Dr. Phil, everything, that people are recognizing this in their own lives, someone's study that they know. And that's we've had calls from people and messages from people that said, because of your story, I'm reassessing where I am. And so they're getting the help they need, and that's very encouraging. Plus, I've you know, been associated with persons like yourself and the Laura Foundation and the other people to realize there is help for people out there, and realize you're not alone in this situation. So I guess that's kind of an encouraging thing, and also that we've been able to help some other people. And as our own case and our own story continues on with no end right now in sight, but what else can we do except for try to help someone else, which is what my daughter would love to do.
With the foundation, what are how can people sign up, help? Do you have a membership? Do you have any active events that you need a helping hand that they can actually call in and support, or even provide any funds or things of that nature for search efforts?
Well, yeah, our immediate needs are okay because, of course, the police are still actively working on the case. It was very helpful when you were able to contact Kimmy Daly's parents, and we were able to help them. That was a great feeling to help someone else. And of course, when we had the Melissa Baum 1 year action, so
yeah.
But we do what we can. We are, you know, a theory behind the foundation is that when you're in the middle of something like this as a parent, as or surviving family members of such a situation, there's so many things going on at once that you don't really know where to turn. And hopefully that when we hear about those things, we can step in and be invited in, hopefully, to help that family out and guide them along so that they can maintain their sanity and do productive things to find their missing loved one or to help them in their time of need. And so we have a unique group of people that have helped us out that are willing to help others out. So we wanted to make that available. Plus, at the time, it seemed like none of these other institutions are. It was hard to find. It's hard to find them. So the fact that we had we still do have a lot of media attention. We can make it known, and people can start to look around and at that website and find if there are sites in their local area that can help them out. Because that's as Uba said earlier. Deborah said, I believe that. Isolation, you feel isolated when you're in these situations and you think there's no help, but there is help. And you just have to look a little bit, or somebody that knows about it and is aware of the situation can refer you to the help that's out there. So that's kind of where we're at with it right now. We do collect funds or do take donations, but we don't have any large search plans at this time. There are people who are searching. The police are still searching, but no real needs at this time other than, if we're called on to do something else for other people. It's always nice to have that ability to go ahead and pay for such things. We have purchased some things like billboards and things like that have been helping in the search, but pretty much, I don't know. Whatever we can do to help somebody else.
Definitely, definitely. And it was a pleasure meeting you both, unfortunately, at Lindsay Baum's 1 year. And I need to remind listeners, especially if you're in the Washington area, that Lindsay Baum is still missing after a year from McCleary, Washington. Deborah, with the difference between domestic violence, I want to dive in a little bit to bullying, because I think this past month we've heard so much about bullying and the LGBTQ hate crimes. What is the difference from calling somebody a name and pushing them up against a wall, et cetera, when you're married to them versus bullying and doing the same kind of activity towards somebody?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think one of the problems is a societal and cultural view that things that happen between two people behind closed doors is a private issue. And we can't really support that view anymore because of the impact it has on the children and the extended family. So, as well as the victim. So we have to open our eyes, take off our blinders, and really try to find ways to hold people accountable for making the choice to be abusive, because that's what it is. It's a choice to be abusive. And I think it's a choice to be a bully. Now, bullying is usually happening in the teenagers, younger adults, children. And so where do children, who are their role models? So what do they see on the media? What television shows are they watching? These are the things that influence a child to think that bullying is acceptable. And so,
they seeing at home and what video games they're playing, too?
Exactly, what video games. And how much time do they have interacting with loving and caring adults around them? I think that makes a difference. But so we, as a Safe Choice Domestic Violence Program, we are trying to focus our efforts more on prevention, which includes speaking to children in schools. We're starting at middle age, so the middle school children and high school. That's where we're at right now. But, really we need to find some support for us to do a larger scale prevention program, because schools have rules. We, the superintendent has to approve curriculum before you can get in there. And then the schools are having their own budgetary issues, and it seems like some parents are supportive of information and education for their children to learn and grow, and then some others would rather not have it be talked about. So there's a lot of things to take into consideration, but we're making strides to reach children at least by the time they're in middle school. And we also are trying to build up our connection to the LGBTQI community in Vancouver and Portland, because there is a definite need when you see people committing suicide after being tormented by a peer. This is just so obvious that kids are in pain and they're not finding any way to get support and ways to manage that. So I think that's a really important aspect.
Didn't the YWCA Clark County, didn't you all just win the Washington State University Community Award last night?
Yes, we were, and that's because of our work on inclusion and diversity in the community. And that's largely based on this type of programming that we're doing.
Well, congratulations on that. I saw that in the paper this afternoon. Congratulations. With the bullying, you know, I commend all of the people that are stepping forward to have a voice now because of the recent teen that killed himself last week off of the George Washington Bridge. But knowing that I work and do a lot with human trafficking out here, one thing that was startling was, and we'll have Don Schiller on the 27th, who will be discussing Esteem, her organization, which deals with throwaway teens. And that was a term that I didn't think that we used too much. But with the LGBT community, we're seeing, especially in the Portland area off of Stark Street, there are numerous, we're talking thousands, of gay youth that because they're gay, they're thrown out onto the street, whether they're bullied or their parents throw them out, and then they choose trafficking as a second way of survival, if you will. And I find it appalling that in our society today that this is still happening. I was bullied as a kid, too. I was a tomboy. I played softball, so I was always picked on that I didn't wear dresses. You know, and for me, I never thought, you know, that I would choose suicide over that. And I find it really sad that in today's world, this is where our youth, you know, are ending up. And so it's great to know that there's organizations like yourself that are educating and are forming programs for prevention for that.
Right. I think the teens who identify as LGBTQI are feeling that isolation that we talked about, that Susan Powell might have been feeling, that I felt as a survivor, that no one really noticed it, nobody cared. I was just the only person who might be going through that. And when they meet others who feel the same way, then they build a bond. And so they think the danger they're facing on the street is less dangerous than the danger at home or at school, I think, is what they're thinking. And so that's a really sad place, a sad commentary on our society and our school systems and the way we raise our young.
Definitely. Just want to let the listeners know, if you know a gay teen and they need some counseling or help, you can go to 866, the number 4U, the letter U, Trevor. 866-4U-TREVOR, that's the Trevor Project, and they will be happy to listen to you. Again, if you'd like to ask Chuck or Deborah any questions on domestic violence, the number is 347-838-8622. Let's talk about the purple lights. I'm seeing purple everywhere. I'm having flashbacks to Prince. Are we in 1999 again? What's going on, Deborah?
Well, the Purple Light Nights campaign was started in Covington, Washington in 2007. And it's kind of grown. Other people are picking it up. It's a real simple act that anybody can take, and it's pretty non-threatening and non-aggressive, which means if we shine a purple light, we are showing support for the kinds of work that programs such as the Best Our Safe Choice program are doing, and for those who live and come out of violent relationships. We're also saying to everybody else in our community that there's no room in our community for domestic violence. So it's kind of been building up over the years. I hear our Attorney General's office also has a purple light on in his office. Rob McKenna is a big supporter of this campaign, and we're just pleased that we're able to join that. So if you drive by our community office at 3609 Main Street in Vancouver, Washington, and it's dusk, you'll see purple light.
Chuck, isn't your color scheme purple too?
Absolutely.
Go ahead.
No, I just, that's Susan's favorite color, and because we were informed that it also is the color for fighting against domestic violence, so we thought it very appropriate.
Wonderful. So we encourage everyone listening tonight to switch out your light bulb, make it energy efficient with a purple light. Is that for the whole month, Deborah?
Yes, for the whole month of October. So join us by flipping the light switch, shine a purple light. We'd enjoy that. We need to have simple ways that people can get involved. And if you have a purple light on your porch or in your window or in your house, when your friends and family come in, they're going to say, hey, why do you have that purple light on? And it gives you a perfect opening to talk about domestic violence and how we need to. It's a serious problem in our communities, and we need to work towards eliminating it.
And I think that's
definitely
very important.
To keep the conversation going.
Yes.
I think that's very important. People don't want to talk about domestic violence. They don't really want to talk about abuse or bullies or all that. It's not a very popular subject, which is understandable, but until we do talk about it and bring this stuff to light, that's the way these people are able to be successful, is because good people don't talk about it and don't. It's not a subject that we're aware of.
Right. I totally
Deborah,
agree.
I noticed that you have some events coming up. In particular, you have one also tomorrow. But I noticed some support groups that you have for teenage girls and other community, like survivors panels. Can you briefly tell us a little bit about that and how people can get involved at any of your events?
Absolutely. We are having our first domestic violence support group for teen girls. It's starting on October 11th. That's a Monday. This group will meet once a week on Mondays from 4 to 5:30 at our community office, which is 3609 Main Street. And this is something that we've been asked to put together. There are so many kids that have been impacted via witnessing and maybe even being in their own teen dating violence relationships that parents and survivors have said, we need something for our girls. So we're excited to have this as a new support group to offer to the community, and we look forward to having some young, passionate participants come to that, and maybe they'll get some information and support so that they don't have to end up in a lifelong cycle of domestic violence.
And for the folks listening that may not be in the Clark County area, the YWCA.org site, will that direct them to a local YWCA in their area?
Yes, it will. And in the state of Washington, there are actually 68 programs that do the similar work, such as what we at Safe Choice do. And we are kind of connected through our state coalition, which is called the Washington State Coalition Against Domestic Violence. But many of us talk to each other, and we say, what's working in your community? And then we'll try it in our community. We share best practices, and this is the direction that our programs have really been moving forward to work with them younger, not waiting till. I mean, I want to tell you that we've had elders in our shelter in the last year. We had 11 senior citizens stay in our shelter, and I know that I wouldn't want that for my mother to have to worry about living in an emergency domestic violence shelter at her age. So we want to get the information to people younger so that this can be prevented and not happen at all.
Great, great. Oh, I believe we have a caller on the line. Caller, you're on the air. Do you have a question for our guests?
Yes. Can you hear me okay?
Hello? I can.
Oh,
welcome
okay.
to Voices for Justice.
Thank you so much. First off, I just want to thank both you as a host and the speakers. This is just wonderful to hear you to be giving airtime for this, and I really appreciate that.
Thank you.
And I forgive me if I missed part of the first if I missed anything of it, I didn't get right at the start. But I also just wanted to check, you know, that I think it's great work that that individual programs and agencies are doing. And as an individual, and I heard about the purple light stuff, and I just thinking of other things that we can do as individuals that maybe not tied directly to an agency, but how, you know, because I get that it can't be just the agencies that are solving this problem. This is our whole community. So what can I as an individual do?
Deborah, Chuck?
Yes, I'm thrilled. Thank you for that question. Yes, absolutely. We are the only domestic violence program in Clark County, and we cannot do it alone. We are trying to work in partnership and in collaboration with all other agencies and people because, you know, you are seeing the abuse go on. And you need to have tools to say, you know, to say or to do. So there are a lot of things you can do. When we often answer questions for family and friends on our hotline, we get that request a lot. I have seen this. I've witnessed it. I'm not sure what I should do. What can I do? And so we'll brainstorm with them. We try to encourage them to stay as close and supportive as you can, be as non-judgmental as you can, and help them widen their circle of support by connecting them to a program such as ours. And if you don't want to do purple lights, you can wear a purple ribbon. You can wear it all year round. I would think that would be beautiful. And, again, the purple ribbon on your jacket or your collar or, you know, your backpack, whatever, it gives people the opportunity to start that conversation. Why do you always have that purple ribbon there? What's up? And it's just great to give us an opportunity to say I'm trying to help people talk about domestic violence. And whenever I do outreach and public talks, I mean, I'm always amazed at the audiences. Usually there's several people that want to visit with me afterwards, and many of them are people who have come through and away from a violent relationship or currently in it or know someone who is, and they really want to help them the best way they can. I say use your voice. Talk about it. Talk about it. Talk about it. And then talk about it some more.
Chuck, any input on that?
Absolutely. Well, first off, be aware that it's out there and provide support to anyone that you or any situation that you feel needs support, you know. We don't just ignore it. We become involved in that. We listen and be a friend, and then refer them to the help centers. But sometimes that's hard for people in that situation to do that referral. So you might have to call and get a little more information yourself, and take a first few steps with them to get them out of the situation. But the more that we work together as a community and for our friends and get to know people and connect with each other, the more likely we are to be able to help these people and help others.
Yes.
Thank you.
Did that
both.
Answer your question, ma'am?
Yes, it did. Thank you very much. And, again, I so appreciate your time.
Thank you. You have any other questions you'd like to ask of them?
Actually, I do, and it's one that I got help around this, and I think it was just such great information. hearing a situation that was a neighbor and sort of being, I think, of the mind or growing up of you stay out of other people's business and, you know, that really isn't, I shouldn't get involved. And it was very distressing to me because I had grown up with that belief and then didn't know what to do and for quite a while had remained silent. And just wondered if you could just either speak just a little bit about that or also, you know, kind of the encouragement that I got of how to get involved.
I forgot to mention that we really love volunteers. People come to us and volunteer at our program, and that's a great way for folks to get involved. We also accept gently used donations to stock our house. We need toasters, coffee makers, twin sheets. We need pillows and towels, and we need food. We need house cleaning kinds of donations. Toilet paper is a big one. Can't live without toilet paper. But
I was hearing the question a little differently. You're wondering what to do about a situation you're aware of.
Yeah, and I mean, and that was good to hear the both the like really tangible way to do it, but I was also thinking, you know, say it's not directly in my family, but it's, you know, I hear something in my neighbor and that's escalating, or I'm in a grocery store and something comes up it's just kind of panicking for me as an observer. Do you have any suggestions?
It's very, you have to be very careful, obviously, because it is their life and what they're doing, but they may not have the ability to recognize it or recognize it as an abusive situation. So if there's a way you can say a word to the person quietly or whatever, like, you know, that seemed a little harsh or something that would break the ice where you can talk with them a little bit and maybe let them know that, you know, you might say, you know, do you need some help or something like that. Anything that you could do, and then just be aware of that. And if you really think it's something serious, of course, you could contact the police about that and let them take care of it. I mean, something imminent. But if other than that, it takes people getting to know people so that you build a little trust so that then you can help them along with that situation. And, you know, that's when you do that, of course, you open yourself up to the situation. Yeah, it could backfire on you that way, and that now you're seen as a negative person in there, or the abuser might see you as a problem. But really, if we do nothing and just, you know, hey, they're on their own, they are on their own, and it just helps the abuser. So
yeah,
whatever you can to try and build a relationship there or provide whatever support is available to you. And, of course, obviously, if it's imminent, certainly just make the phone call yourself.
Great. Thank you very much, both of you, all three of you.
Thank you very much for calling in, ma'am.
Uh-huh. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. We have about 5 minutes left of the show, and I just wanted to mention a couple websites again, SusanCoxFoundation.org. We also have dvam.org, and if you look at our website at blogtalkradio.com/helpingheroes, in the link area, you'll see DVAM, D-V-A-M, and all of the links from tonight are listed under that acronym, and that stands for Domestic Violence Awareness Month, and you can download banners, you can buy a T-shirt, you can download things for Facebook, things of that nature, and that's, again, dvam.org. We also have the YWCA ClarkCounty.org. You can also visit the hotline.org. The hotline is the National Center hotline number as well, and that number is 800-799-SAFE. If you need some services for sexual assault, if you're a victim or know a victim, 800-656-HOPE. And then teen dating, very important. If you are a teenager and you're going to listen to this podcast after, or you know a friend, in school, out of school, that needs some help because you believe that they may be being abused, dial 866-331-9474. And something that hits closer to home with many of us, I know Deborah sits on our committee as well, is human trafficking. Portland ranks number 2 in the country, and Seattle ranks number 1. And before human trafficking ever starts, other components are things that begin to escalate. One could be a kidnapping and abduction, but a lot of the time domestic violence plays a factor before someone actually gets pushed out on a street to prostitute themselves. And most of these are at an average age of 12 and 13 years of age. So if you are a victim or you know someone being trafficked in the United States, please dial 888-373-7888, or you can visit us at nwcat.org. And again, Victor Rivers, Private Family Matter, great book to pick up. Any last thoughts, Chuck, and anything that you'd like our listeners and those? This show tends to have a lot of downloads. So hopefully those that download the podcast and share this link, what message do you want to send them?
Well, your family life and the way you're treated in your family, you should be treated with respect, you should feel safe, and you should, your opinion should be respected. And if you're not being treated that way, don't assume it's going to get better. Just be very careful about that, and too often we stay in a situation too long. And anyway, that's all.
Well, again, SusanCoxFoundation.org. Get to know Susan's case. Be the eyes and ears that the police need to help bring Susan home. Deborah, any last thoughts?
Well, I just want to thank you for the opportunity. I really love my work, and I enjoy talking about it, but what's really important is that the community gets the information that they need so that they can help. I mean, you know, change begins at home, and if we can support those we love who may be in an abusive relationship, that's the most important thing you'll ever do. And if you improve the life of a woman, you improve the life of her family and the community. So that's something to think about. I just want everybody to think about doing one concrete action every day during the month of October to raise awareness with their friends and family about domestic violence, whether it's a Facebook post or a purple ribbon or flipping a purple light on anything. Whatever it is you think you can do best, help us raise the awareness.
Thank you. Thank you, Chuck. Thank you, Deborah, and also to the YWCA. That is home to our Seroptimus meeting, so thank you for all that you do. And thank you for being helping heroes in our community against violence. The YWCA continues eliminating racism and empowering women, so we really do encourage you to get to know them. Our next show is October 27th. We sit down and talk with Dawn Schiller. She is the author of The Road Through Wonderland, Surviving John Holmes. For those of you that were back in the 70s, you'll remember John Holmes as one of the big porn kings, and his kidnapped victim was Dawn Schiller, and she has survived Wonderland, and she's going to talk with us on October 27th. All of us can be the voice for justice. What are you doing this week to make a difference? And until we meet again, be the change you wish to see in the world. Thank you, everyone, and thank you again, Chuck and Deborah.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Can anybody out there hear my voice? Does anybody out there really care for a missing child? I'm a stranger in a strange place, and I don't know how I got here. I'm so far away from home. I would run, but I'm afraid to, 'cause I don't know what would happen. Could I make it all alone? If I could get someone's attention, one kind soul to look my way, maybe you would recognize me from the picture.